Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Campus Conservative. My name is Robert Sasso. I'm the new host. Little about me as I introduce myself. I'm a rising sophomore at Bentley University. I'm a major in economics and finance, as well as a minor in politics. I've joined Lone Conservative recently at the end of April, and I've also been on the program On the Line TV. If you've seen that, I'm a regular panelist there, and I'm taking over as the host of the Campus Conservative. And we'll get right into it with my first guest. We're going to go north of the border. She's the host of Right Millennial, co-owner of HazleyNews.com, contributor at Lone Conservative, writer, mom, troublemaker, and truth teller. I'm describing the one Stephanie McWilliams. How are you doing today, Stephanie?
I am doing great, Robert. Thank you so much for inviting me to the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you on. It's going to be interesting as we're going to be going to Canada to talk about a few political issues in America. So it's going to be a very interesting perspective. We're going to lay out the agenda right now. First, we're going to talk about the Scalise shootings and gun rights. Then we're going to hop into the Laura Loomer fiasco and kind of the whole controversy around that, as well as America through the lens of a Canadian. We're going to see what Stephanie has to say about some of the top issues in America and kind of how she views freedom. And then we're going to end talking about the millennial experience in the right-wing media. That one is going to be a very interesting one. So to begin, we're going to talk about Steve Scalise shooting. So to begin, she said she wanted to talk about something from a Canadian perspective, and I think the first issue we're going to lay out is when you talk about the shooting, you could see that the shooter was able to own a gun, pretty high-powered rifle, that every American can buy. Basically, if you can pass a background check, you can get it. So basically what I want to ask Stephanie is, what are the gun rights in Canada? Could this have happened feasibly, legally?
In Canada, I believe it could have happened legally because I'm not too sure on the specifics of what sorts of guns you can own in Canada, but I certainly know that despite popular belief, Canada actually has a lot of guns despite having what I believe to be extremely regressive gun laws. So just kind of the basics, we have no equivalent of the Second Amendment. Our self-defense rights are basically non-existent in my view. Basically how it is if you're being attacked, if somebody was to beat me up in the street, I would be able to use reasonable force to defend myself. However, if I were to carry any sort of weapon with the intent of defending myself, that would be illegal under Canadian law. So that includes things like pocket knives for the use of self-defense, pepper spray for the use of self-defense. So basically, I am entirely dependent on the police if I want to do things without breaking the law. Of course, people get around this a little bit by doing things like carrying dog spray, which is supposed to be for, you know, fending off dogs when you're running or whatever, but people do use it for self-defense. But technically speaking, if I were to be pulled over in a traffic stop with that in my purse and didn't have an explanation, I could legally be in trouble. So in Canada, I think people look at a situation like the Scalise shooting and they think, oh, this couldn't happen here because we can't buy guns. But I always kind of tell people that Canada, in a way, to me, is a good example of why more guns do not necessarily equal more crime. Canada has 36 million people and 10 million guns, and we have very low gun homicide rates. So it's a little bit interesting.
Well, one thing you hit on at the very beginning, which I find very interesting, is that Canada doesn't have the natural idea that self-preservation is a very good thing, should be a fundamental right of citizens. And I think in America, you see it enshrined in the Second Amendment that it's basically a way to hedge against government tyranny to have a gun. That's why we have in order to have the right for a well-regulated militia. We want to make sure that if government gets tyrannical, the people are able to fight back. And I think a lot of politicians and a lot of gun experts have said that if there was a popular uprising among gun owners, they don't think the army could stand a chance because there's just so many guns out there. In a good sense, that there's legal owners, people who want to stay armed, there's people who want to stay up to date on the gun issues of the day. And I think that's a very good thing. I think in Canada, they have this liberal or progressive mindset that you don't need to protect yourself, that you're fine with the police coming to help you, or less guns, less crime. It's kind of the cliches that they all believe in. And I think that it's very foolhardy to believe that the shooting could have been prevented if this guy wasn't able to hold a gun, because if someone has a will, there's a way. And I think that, like, I don't think you touched on it a lot, but I think we could say that more guns would have helped, because if the politicians weren't coming from D.C., which has very strict gun laws, they most likely could have been carrying guns. And all it takes is one guy to pull out a gun, and this guy's going to be double, triple teamed. They'll have many, many dozens of congressmen on him, and he would have been able to take down much shooters without Steve Scalise having to go through such intensive care. And a little thing that I heard on Glenn Beck's program is that this guy was very lucky that from the range he was shooting with, the gun he was shooting with, the fact that Steve Scalise is not 6 feet under right now is nothing short of a miracle. And I think that this should be a wake-up call. And kind of transitioning into my next question is, political violence in America is, I wouldn't say it's ramping up, but I think there's a few hot spots where we've seen it. How would Canadians view this political violence? Would they condone it? Would they think it's reasonable in the discourse? How does that go down in Canada?
Well, I mean, Canada overall, despite being extremely kind of liberal progressive, we're also a very nice country. So I feel like it's a lot of the attitude tends to be, can't we all just get along? However, how that attitude is manifested in policy is not always so great. I think it's more that we tolerate things that we probably shouldn't. I'm not talking about in the sense of allowing people to speak. Of course, the freedom, you know, Canada also does not have absolute right to freedom of speech, but that's a whole other thing about Canada. I feel like it isn't seen as acceptable. I think people were genuinely horrified by things like Scalise being shot. I mean, anyone that I've spoken to in Canada is. But I don't think they realize that their rhetoric of Donald Trump being the worst thing of all time and literally Hitler. I mean, I don't like this idea that, you know, words equal violence, but I do get that when you create this climate, you do have to be careful. And I think as the public, we need to be careful with who we're listening to, what we're saying, because people do in a way become sort of radicalized with these things. And it's interesting with looking at the Scalise shooting that Canadians and American liberals alike seem to see this as, I've actually saw several tweets saying, oh, well, maybe now that the Republicans have had one of their own get hurt, they'll finally wake up on gun laws. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? It's just proving already what we believe, that these people should have had the rights to defend themselves. I think when you look at these sorts of situations and there are always heroes in bad situations. And when you have a tool like a gun, you can either have the tool strictly in the hands of the bad guys, or you can have that tool in the hands of heroes or potential heroes. So Canadians don't get it, and neither do American liberals.
Yeah, and I think you hit on it. Like, you wanted to say that they want Canadian liberals and American liberals. They wanted to say, ah, the right, they're done now. They're just fooled by their own hypocrisy that guns are going to be the violence. They're not the violence, it's the people. And now one of their own has been shot, critically injured. Why not more gun laws? And I think that it's very, very disturbing when they make this argument, because if you think about it, they would, if the police weren't there, Scalise, he had a protection because he's in the line of succession, because he would have been ready to go if something happened to Paul Ryan, God forbid. So he would have had a little bit of protection. He was also in the leadership. If that wasn't there and these congressmen were mowed down, it'd be very interesting to see how they would force American conservatives to act with 10% of Republicans wiped away from Congress. Would they force Republicans to enact hate speech legislation, strict gun laws to prevent this from happening again? It's very interesting to say that if the protection wasn't there, this could have been one of the greatest tragedies and horrific events in American history. And it could have absolutely – yeah, it could have absolutely changed the course of American history for the worse. And I think that when you reflect on this, it's very you should be very wary of the fact that we are one tragedy away from having our rights kind of trampled on. Because as Rahm Emanuel said, never let a crisis go to waste. And I think that the liberals tried to make this a huge crisis. I think they didn't. It was kind of a catch-22 with them, because they wanted to kind of politicize this with the gun issues. But then again, it was a Republican that got shot. They didn't really want to blow that issue up. They kind of wanted that to be pushed off to the side. And I think we talk about hypocrisy again. Elizabeth Warren, I don't know if you saw the video she just cut about the American Health Care Act, which personally I think is 95% Obamacare, but that's not what I'm talking about here. It's the fact that she said it was blood money from the Republicans. And I think that after calling for less violent rhetoric, especially with what Trump said about paying for the legal fees of people who punch people at rallies, how do you view that the left is just going right back to this rhetoric where they're going to be vitriolic towards the right? How do you think that plays in the politics after the shooting?
Well, I think it's unfortunate they never really seem to learn that it's kind of, in a partisan sense, it's honestly helpful to the right that the left refuses to give up their ridiculous violence and all this stuff. But on the other hand, you know, for the sake of America, I'm not so sure it's a good thing that people are so obsessed with. I think so much of it, what bothers me about the political violence rhetoric is not so much that I believe almost any of these words are, you know, directly radicalizing people or anything like that. I think what it more bothers me is that it's a way of ensuring how, you know, ensuring the ignorance of people. Because when you see some of these big Democrats and liberals and, you know, Johnny Depp saying about assassinating a president and yada yada, it's not so much that it bothers me because I think someone's going to be like, ha, Johnny Depp said to assassinate the president, I'm going to try. It bothers me because it's basically telling the average normal not psychopath, oh, Johnny Depp literally thinks he should be assassinated. Therefore, Trump must be completely irredeemable and terrible, and I'm not going to really look into the pros and cons of him myself. So that's what bothers me the most about it.
Yeah, and you talked about the Johnny Depp thing. Now, what I think you said earlier, which I also agree with, that words don't condone violence, because I think what you're saying is that when you're saying something violent, a person who acts on it does not have the moral agency to kind of prevent themselves from doing it. I kind of create this analogy where it's like, if your teammate says you're going to strike out and you go up to the batter's box and you strike out, whose fault is it? Or if your brother is kind of messing with you and he says you're going to fail your math test tomorrow and you don't study and you fail your math test, whose fault is it? Like, they said it, but it's obviously on you to perform the action. If you fail a test, it's not your brother's fault because he said it. It's your fault because you didn't study. And I think going back to that, when you don't think that words matter, as we transition into this Laura Loomer fiasco, which I think is – just over the top insane. You see that these people think that if someone puts on something violent or they kind of attack a political opponent, it's supposed to be shut down. It's supposed to be hate speech, supposed to be violent rhetoric that's going to trigger probably the 1 or 2% on each side of the aisle to act violently on that rhetoric. And I think that's very foolhardy. And I want to transition to that by pointing to one of your tweets that you put in one of your latest article on Haisley News, where it says, it sure seems to me like the new right is in the club of people whose guiding principle is there's no such thing as bad publicity. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that I think that they have taken political pragmatism to an extreme level. Now, I'm actually somebody who considers myself to be quite pragmatic on a lot of things. Once in a while, I will get annoyed with certain Republicans because they seem so unwilling to give on anything that they ultimately win nothing. So I think there's a line there. But what bothers me about the new right is they have decided that there should be absolutely no principles at all and everything should be based on pragmatism and on winning. And I feel like that's what they're saying. When I criticize this Laura Loomer thing, I criticize it right from the beginning and took a lot of flack for it. And, you know, people like Jack Posobiec are tweeting, oh, well, 24 hours later, we're still talking about it. And I'm thinking, how is that a measure of success? You know, there are a lot of things I could do that would be, you know, get people talking that doesn't necessarily make them good. So that really frustrates me. I do think that is their principle at this point.
Well, you say the new right. I'll give you a second to define that after I talk. But what I want to say is I think we say that these people are far right, they're Trump right, there are some people even say they're conservatives. I would like to classify them, even though it's kind of a budding movement, I would like to classify them as anti-left. And what I mean by that is you talk about their guiding principle. I think the anti-left's guiding principle is do whatever annoys the left. So when you look at Jack Posobiec or whatever his name is, he's really not a relevant person. He tweeted something out in April about Ann Coulter when she got shut down. It was a Breitbart article saying UC Berkeley got cucked and Ann Coulter banned. And obviously he was rightly out against the left banning Ann Coulter as hate speech. She isn't. She's a Trump person, but she's not a hateful person. She just wants to see a border wall built. And then they go and storm a play, and they call the liberals that are performing this play Joseph Goebbels, a minister of propaganda in Germany, which I think is beyond a ludicrous comparison. So when you talk about this, it kind of transitions to another quote I'm going to pull from the article, applying leftist tactics will ultimately undermine our shared goals on the right. And naturally, I've taken criticism for my positions. So first, define new right and why have you taken a lot of criticism for not wanting to apply leftist tactics on the right?
Well, how I would define the new right, I actually really like your terminology of the anti-left because I think ultimately you're right. Many of these people do, I believe, have some conservative values that they would like to see. My problem is that their entire way to get there is very different than how somebody like myself would approach it, where I'm kind of somewhere in the middle between a very principled conservative and a bit of a pragmatist. But it's not so much that they're not conservatives to me, it's that they're conservatives second and they're anti-left right. So I'd say for the new right, I would define them basically as the sort of people who are not particularly committed to principles. They are very committed to attention, to the media, to crafting their own sort of world amongst themselves. I found it's genuinely a very small movement if you really think about it. It's a very core group of people, particularly on Twitter, probably about 20 to 30 people, and then of course another several thousand kind of in their circle, but it's a very small movement. And I think, but they have really wielded undue influence, actually. And I've taken a lot of criticism for criticizing these people because they always say, oh, you're punching right, and we need to be united. And to me, there are certain things where I feel like as a group, you have to be united on, even if you may have differing ways of getting to a goal. For example, I can understand the argument that all conservatives need to vote for Donald Trump because he's the only way we can not get Hillary Clinton. That makes sense to me. What doesn't make sense to me is Stephanie cannot criticize Mike Cernovich because we're both on the right and we both, you know, want a conservative government. Therefore, I shouldn't be allowed to say anything. I mean, I find it ridiculous. And also, it's impractical. All that happens when you say that we can't punch right and we can't criticize our own is that all the criticism happens in private and we end up with all the worst arguments on every side of everything.
Yeah. And basing off what you said, when you talk about the 20 to 30 people you think it's on Twitter, you have to kind of take into consideration in the age of social media how much noise doesn't always correlate with size. Because when you look at this alt-right movement, people tried to blow it up into something it really wasn't. They've kind of disappeared after the election. But you go back to 2010 and you look at the Tea Party movement, they were there protesting, but they were fairly quiet. They weren't making a lot of headwinds in the media, making a lot of noise besides the leftist mainstream media calling them out for being racist for what they're not. And then they end up in the 2010 midterm elections sweeping 63 seats. And I think that people didn't see it coming because they were so quiet. But then you see these loud voices on the anti-left for Trump, and they're making a lot of noise. But then you really look into it. It's really just three or four people just trying to raise money for their alleged causes and trying to boost their Twitter following by just backing everything they do, whether it's pro-Trump or anti-left. And I think it kind of comes to my next point. Another quote I liked from your article that says, "The right-wing media constantly rewards people who deserve it least." Now, you talked about this. Why do you think this is so damaging for the right?
Well, I think it's damaging to the right because people are not seeing the best argument. People are seeing some of the dumbest arguments ever. Arguments that are not based on any sort of principle, any sort of study. I mean, ultimately, I'm a free market capitalist. So if people want to watch Laura Loomer more than they want to watch, I don't know, Steven Crowder, that's up to them, obviously. But I feel like it ends up being damaging because people see these popular voices, and it's basically like living in a giant high school, because everybody is just there to socialize and nobody's there to actually learn anything. And I don't necessarily feel like it's a matter of, okay, somebody genuinely is bored by, I don't know, Ben Shapiro and is genuinely interested in Mike Cernovich. I think it's more that through the use of social media and this small group of people artificially inflates the popularity of someone like Mike Cernovich while insulting and attacking someone like Ben Shapiro because he's a cuck or he's bringing the movement down or whatever they say.
Yeah, I think the age of social media really plays up these people because I don't know how a voice like Jack Posobiec or Laura Loomer would really get into the social fabric if it wasn't for their ability to just tweet something out. Because when you look at coming up through the history before there was really any online media, digital media, you had like places like the National Review, which was a magazine, or Reason, which was a magazine. These were very intellectual, very thought-provoking policy journals, which allowed people to read and understand issues. But now since the culture is so ingrained into everything we do, you see a lot of politics getting a lot of tribalistic because people like to see something they agree with. And if it's something cultural like storming a play where Trump dies as playing Julius Caesar, people like to see that even though it might not be the best thing to support. And now I kind of want to transition to another quote. This one I really found interesting. It says, "Not only does she have the gall to think she's some sort of courageous hero for yelling on stage in a city full of gunless liberal idiots, she calls people who do not engage in her stunt behavior lazy and cowardly." So you kind of talked about how she insulted Ben Shapiro. So how does this end up tying in? How does this hurt How is her argument hurt by the fact that she's kind of being hypocritical here when you talk about her people being lazy and cowardly for not running on stage?
Well, I think it just shows how, as you said, these people that are in social media don't really know how to do any sort of actual work. I mean, I'm not knocking social media. I'm an absolute Twitter addict. I love Twitter. I'm on there all the time. I love it because I get to talk to my readers constantly. It's so much fun. I enjoy it. And you know what? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. My issue is when people who do nothing but tweet are seen as some sort of, you know, political hero or someone to base your ideas off of, I find that gets to be a bit of a problem because, like you said, it's not particularly intellectual. It's 140 characters. I mean, what do you want? People read my Twitter because I like to, you know, have sassy arguments with liberals, but people read my articles, I hope, because I like to delve into my ideas a little bit. And the thing with defending Ben Shapiro is it's actually funny that I found myself defending him in that way because I have had plenty of disagreements with Ben Shapiro. I mean, there are certain things where I'm just like, dude, let up. You know, like he'll be upset about a joke that Trump made. I'm just like, I don't care. I find this silly nitpicking. However, for her to go there and say that Ben Shapiro sits on a couch, I find that if you're going to attack somebody, attack their best point. Do not attack something that is blatantly ridiculous. It actually just really annoyed me. And a big thing in how I write is I take a very personal approach and a very honest approach. And people are like, oh, you're just jealous. You're just this. And I'm like, okay, I can totally fully admit that I'm slightly jealous that, you know, the kind of fame and the, you know, financial stability that I literally work my butt off 7 days a week for is quite literally handed to somebody for standing for 30 seconds at a play. And I think if we'd be a little more honest about that with each other, instead of trying to act like we're above it all, we might start actually promoting good voices. And not necessarily me, just people who actually put work in, instead of putting in the popular girl in the high school as being some sort of hero. That's what bothers me.
So you mentioned something before I go back to your article, but actually a question just popped up in my mind. It was perfect because you mentioned it when you talk about kind of talking to your followers on Twitter and kind of interacting with what you call the idiot liberals. And I think it's really interesting because with social media, you get this very unique instant feedback. And since you just crossed over 9,000 followers, you obviously know how important it is to connect with your followers and how important it is that they see what content you're putting out. So obviously you take a different approach than these two anti-lefters do. How do you think this kind of instant feedback you can get from your followers through a retweet or a like or a mention, how does this kind of affect the way you talk on social media and the way that you write? Because obviously when people are instantly liking or disliking or unfollowing you for what you say, it's going to have an effect on what you do regardless of how much you think it doesn't. So what do you worry about when you see this instant feedback either helping you or hurting you?
Well, that's my absolute way that I go about my writing, actually, is that I find it helps me in a way to get this sort of feedback because I'm very aware of it. As you said, you are always affected by what people think of you. Ultimately, anybody who is in any sort of media is going to have to some level cater to their audience. And the thing is knowing how far to go. And what I try to do is just be extremely honest about it when I am feeling that way. When I am feeling like if I had this feeling that I'm like, okay, I want to say thing A, but I'm really scared I'm going to piss off my audience, so I'm debating saying thing B, I would tweet about it. I would say, I'm really conflicted about this because I know it's going to piss off my audience. I really believe in thing A, but what do you guys think? Because I feel conflicted and I want to, you know, I don't want to say thing B, but I feel compelled to. I try to have a very open, honest conversation with my audience. And I find that people like that because I don't try to, you know, say that I have the answer to everything, right? Because ultimately, sometimes I say things and I lose like 30 followers and that sucks. But at the end of the day, I would rather be honest and I try to minimize the pandering as much as humanly possible because, like you said, this age of instant gratification and, you know, I tweet an article. Of course, it feels really good when it gets retweets. I mean, it's psychologically proven that sort of instant social gratification feels good. But I think we have to look at that, accept it, and then try and move past it as much as possible.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point you bring up where you have to talk about the marketplace of ideas, it's very, very much like a pure free market because it's very big cost benefit analysis you have to do when you're talking about something or tweeting about something, because obviously you have to balance the relationship between saying what I want to say, saying what's going to kind of get my network expanded, saying things that are going to provoke a discussion. So it's kind of like you have to you have to see what benefit you get from writing something. And I think that's very interesting. And I just want to finish up with one more quote. This is from the end of your article that I've been referencing the whole time, which I encourage everyone to read.
Thank you.
You say, "I didn't write this, any of this, to be a jerk or attack you, your personality. I'm sure you're a nice girl, but if you want to last in this business, I suggest you consider my points and the points of the other so-called cucks you're ranting on Twitter." So this doesn't have to be addressed to Laura exactly, but to kind of anyone who wants to make a name for themselves, have their face in the political discussion, especially on the right side of the aisle. Where does she go wrong, and where do you think people ought to go if they want to make an impactful and good difference?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think, first of all, I just want to clarify that I don't mean to speak as some sort of like expert authority. I am not any sort of, and that's why I reference Ben Shapiro a lot, because he is actually a veteran in this business. I'm not. I mean, I work hard, but I'm relatively new to this job in general. But I have learned a lot of things because I have had a lot of controversies thrown my way, even small ones, where I have found myself at that critical junction where I say, okay, do I say what I believe, or do I say what will make people happier? Do I say what I believe, or will I maintain a networking contact? And I think that the only thing that Laura can do is just be, she's going to have to be a lot more careful than somebody like I have to be, because ultimately I know, realistically speaking, the chances of me breaking out and getting sort of Twitter famous or super well known in the media is slim. I think it's going to take me a while to build my following. And I think that's a good thing, honestly. I mean, if it happens, great, but ultimately the experience of interacting back and forth with people, dealing with networking, dealing with doing the real work that Laura Loomer says she's doing, that, oh, I'm doing the real work while you sit there. But the real work is not glamorous. The real work is sometimes extremely boring, thankless. You know, you don't even know if anyone's going to care what you're doing. I think over time, because I've gone through these small controversies, if I ever, God willing, get to a point where my platform's bigger, I think I'm going to be equipped to deal with these sorts of controversies. And I don't see Laura Loomer doing that. I see her just sniping at people in the most ridiculous fashion. And it's not doing well for her. And I find it in my article, I stated that I can't believe that I'm agreeing with Baked Alaska, Richard Spencer, and the New York Times. I mean, it's just bizarro world.
Yeah. It's really, really interesting to see where the politics are going in the Trump era. I think that it's not Trump's fault per se, but I think that his follower base is very interesting to look at, because I think they came out of the woodworks with him. I think these people were sitting there, and I think the timing was just a perfect storm where these people were able to come out. So enough on the Laura Loomer controversy. Hopefully the anti-left can tamper down so we can actually get some conservative ideals in the administration for Trump. And I want to transition to the view of America from Canada.
Awesome.
So here, it's very interesting because Canada is kind of going in the opposite direction of America. America, over the last 8 years, has trended more conservative, while when you look at the 2015 federal elections in Canada, the first party to win was the Liberal Party, headed by Justin Trudeau, and they absolutely blew out everyone else. They were the only party besides Quebec Bloc. They probably said it wrong because the French version, but they were they were the only party to actually gain seats. The Conservatives took a huge hit. They lost the prime ministership, and Justin Trudeau took the seat. So what's going on in Canada? Why have they moved further to the left while America's moved further to the right? Is it a whole thing in the world, or is it kind of just Canadian politics gone bad for the Conservatives?
Well, I think that Canada, it's a difficult thing, because I don't think we were ever really conservative at all. The thing I find with Canada is, just because we had a conservative prime minister for two terms, whatever, before Justin Trudeau came into power, we still have a very liberal culture in Canada. And I think it's important also for people to remember, context-wise, is that Canada is an extremely new country. You know, we're celebrating this year our 150th anniversary of Confederation. You know, so you look at that compared to the United States, and it's very clear that we've had a lot less time to kind of come into our own. And I feel like, despite being next door to Canada, a lot of things that I find we kind of are kind of slow on the uptake, and then eventually America does it, and we kind of are like, okay, I guess maybe this is a good idea, like 20 years later. So I kind of see that happening a little bit right now. For me, it's just, it's, I mean, it's also where you live geographically. I lived in Alberta for a year and a half. There's a lot more conservatism in Alberta. Where I live now in Ontario, which is where almost all like Canadians live, is in my area of Ontario, basically. So many people are leftist. It's just, it's almost just like a giant province-wide hive mind at this point.
Yeah, I just quickly looked at the breakdown of what looks like each province is sending to the parliament, and it looks like kind of like America, the center of the country, looks to tend more towards the conservative side. The middle's kind of in the middle, obviously, is in the middle, like the Rust Belt in America, and I think the coasts are fairly more liberal, even though they're very, very small.
Yeah, provinces. Right.
So
tiny little coasts.
Yeah, so one of the biggest misconceptions on the international stage is kind of that American conservatism can be linked to the right, quote-unquote, abroad. So when you look at the Conservative Party, the head of the Conservative Party now, I think you guys just had an election, just had the leader, Andrew Scheer, it looks like just won, very, very small margin. Where would you equate them on the political spectrum if they were to be in America? Would they be conservatives? Would they be moderates? Would they be liberals? Kind of where does it translate for a conservative in Canada?
I would say that they are mostly kind of right of center moderates. I don't know as much about all the candidates. I focus a lot more on American politics than Canadian. But what I do know is that I feel like Stephen Harper was in a lot of ways more moderate. And I think a lot of the new crop of conservative leadership candidates have kind of moved to the right a little bit. And I think possibly the Trump era has emboldened that a little bit. I really wanted Maxime Bernier to win because he's a lot more of a kind of libertarian conservative. Unfortunately, he just lost to Andrew Scheer, who I will still be voting for in 2019, but I'm a little bit disappointed. But overall, you know, anything in Canada that's conservative is still generally to the left of American conservatism, particularly when we look at certain issues that are just not as big of a thing to Canadians, such as, you know, gun laws and freedom of speech and freedom of religion and things like that.
Yeah, it's very interesting because one thing that you guys have that unfortunately America is tending towards is kind of a universal healthcare system. And I think that it must be hard even as a conservative to fight against that, because obviously when you take away an entitlement, there's going to be a huge transition period, which no one wants to go through. And that can cost you a lot of seats. And in a very liberal country, like you said, that could even cost you your party's chances of ever winning an election again. So I think there's a very delicate line that a conservative internationally has to balance, seeing there's so many social programs they have to deal with. So leaving Canada alone for now, I want to transition to your view of America. This is a very broad question. I intentionally left it broad because I want to see what you have to say on it. It's, what is freedom to a Canadian? How do you view freedom?
Well, I guess it depends if you mean to a general Canadian or to me as a Canadian, because I think to a general Canadian, in a broad sense, I think Canadians and Americans want the same things in the sense of freedom. You know, they want to just live their lives. I think that's what most of us would want, right or left. However, to most Canadians, they do not see the necessity of minimizing government intervention in achieving that goal, particularly when it comes to things such as the freedom of speech and the right to bear arms. Me as a Canadian, I have moved a lot farther to the right over the years. I was raised in a very kind of liberal family. My mom and sisters are very socially and fiscally liberal. My dad is more somewhat socially conservative, just being religious, but he's fiscally liberal as well. He actually works for the government. And I was definitely raised in that worldview. So growing up, I completely understand the Canadian mindset, because the thing is, in Canada, we almost have it too good in a lot of ways. And now that things are starting to change, I think people are finally realizing, wait a minute, this like lovely country we have is not going to be there forever if we, you know, if you, the cost of liberty is eternal vigilance, right? And I think Canadians have really gotten away with just keeping their eyes closed and assuming the freedoms that we do have. I'm not going to say Canada is a terrible country, but there are certain things that I find extremely concerning. Freedom to me would be, first of all, the freedom of speech and the freedom of expression. I think that it's a disgrace that in Canada that we have things like hate speech laws. It always frightens me that it's, you know, at some point I'm going to say something about Islam or something on Twitter and I'm going to be in trouble legally. So that's always a risk. I definitely don't like that we don't. I think the freedom to bear arms is huge. It frustrates me that I have no such rights. Those are two of the biggest ones. And I think that those are the ones I focus on the most in my work for Halsey News and Right Millennial, because those are the freedoms that give people the chance to protect all other freedoms. And also, as somebody who is pro-life, Canada's abortion laws also really frustrated me. So I think the right to life is not protected at all in Canada either.
Yeah, so what you hit on when you talked about what freedom means to you, you described what are called negative liberties. Negative liberties are kind of freedoms of you have the freedom of speech. No one has the right to restrict your speech, freedom to defend yourself. Absolutely. No one has the right to take that away. And I think when people say America liberty is different than any other liberty in the world, they're correct, because national health care is, it's a positive liberty, which means it's an entitlement, means that the government has – you have the right that the government gives it to you. And that means your personal liberties, your negative liberties are attacked. And I think when you're talking about the freedom of expression, you have to look at a law that was passed – it looks like a law that was passed earlier this month. It's called Bill C-16. Mm-hmm. Trudeau tweeted about it, making it – this is his tweet, word for word – making it illegal to discriminate based on gender, identity, or expression. So that means if I were to go to Canada and you were to call me sir, I could potentially have you face criminal charges because you didn't ask what I identified as. And I think that's – very, very dangerous, because all it just takes is, even if you're taking a silly example or just kids playing pranks on each other and saying, oh, you misgendered me, like in public, someone can get in trouble for that. And that's really, really dangerous, because then you're entering this kind of thought of mental slavery. Andrew Klavan likes to say that. It's basically where you're policing yourself when you what you want to say, not in a sense of social decorum, but a sense of, I'm going to be in trouble if I say something. So that leads me to my next question. You talk about negative liberties. Do you feel that they are under attack, or they've always been under attack while you've been in Canada?
Well, that's interesting you put it in terms of negative versus positive liberties. I actually had not put that in those terms that way. I mean, I've heard the terms, but I never thought, oh, Canada is a lot more concerned with positive liberties versus negative ones. But I don't believe we've really ever had those negative liberties, particularly. I mean, things like our gun laws, as far as I know, again, I'm far more interested in the United States, just that's kind of where my work is focused. However, you know, as far as I know, we've never really had, you know, great freedom of speech protections. We've never had great, you know, freedom of self-defense protections. I don't really feel we've ever had that. My thing that what I faced was that, similar to most Canadians, I think I had the privilege of simply not having to worry about it. I didn't write about things that could be politically dangerous. I didn't, you know, get threats from people where I worried about not being able to defend myself. And now, in this line of work where I have experienced those things, where I have talked about things that could probably be considered, you know, at least legally questionable under Canadian hate speech laws, which is crazy when you think about it, because I really don't say anything hateful about people, but that's a whole other thing. That and getting threats, and for the first time in my life, I've actually thought to myself, I really wish I could just carry a gun, because people are crazy. People have, you know, said the Starbucks I go to work at. People have sent me horrible threats. You know, of course, most of them, I'm sure, just being stupid, but the possibility's there. So I don't think we've ever really had those rights. I just think most Canadians don't realize how easy it is to find yourself one of those people that really wishes that we had those liberties.
Yeah, you've said it. I probably don't even think you realize it, but you said that you don't think you're being hateful, and that's the whole fallacy behind hate speech laws. Like, you don't think you're being hateful. Maybe some transgender, biracial midget thinks you're being hateful towards them. So who determines what is hateful? It's obviously going to be some bureaucrat if the government decides that. And if it's a conservative bureaucrat, maybe pro-abortion stuff is going to be hateful, or maybe – when it's a liberal, maybe anything conservative says is hateful. And I think it's really dangerous when you have someone policing and defining what speech is hateful. And I think when you think about it, you think of a crazy example where someone, like maybe a teacher whose name is Miss Monday, and a kid comes in a shirt saying, I hate Mondays. Is that kid being hateful? Like, does that – I mean, it's silly, but I mean, when you talk about laws, you have to look at the extremes of the laws. And if the extremes of the laws don't make any sense, then you really can't apply that law. And I think when you look at hate speech laws, they do get pretty insane, because anything could be put under hate speech. And then one more thing I want to point out here is that you said that you talk about American politics a lot. So what do you wish Canada would incorporate from America, whether it be politics or culture? What do you think that Canada needs the most from America right now?
I think that culture has to come first. I totally believe that politics is downstream of culture. And I think especially when you have a situation like we do in Canada, where we do not have those kind of founding fathers with their ideas to draw from, I think we have to start culturally to make Canadians understand these things about liberty, these basic things that in the United States are just assumed because of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and those sorts of founding documents. I think you have to start with culture. But I also think we need to genuinely look at the sort of, I think freedom of speech is my absolute priority. As a Canadian and as somebody who talks about America and as somebody who talks about Europe, I think that the free marketplace of ideas is the absolute most important thing, because without that, no other rights really ultimately are going to be as effective, right? Because you can't debate them. You know, if you can't debate an idea, then how on earth are you ever expecting to make progress? It, like you said, it's just going to be some bureaucrat who decides, we can debate this idea on, you know, we can debate this idea, we can debate if this is a good policy, but we need to all be able to do that. So that's the biggest thing for me. Freedom of speech, I think we should get a culture that celebrates freedom of speech. And then I do think we should look at loosening a lot of our gun laws. I think we should... I think it's funny because I really don't think homicide rates or anything like that would go up in Canada if we were to loosen our gun laws. I really don't, because what is really stopping people now? I don't think people get that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think the quote you mentioned, politics is downstream from culture, the great Andrew Breitbart, mm-hmm. he would always say that. That's why he was so successful. He could care less about policy. I'm currently reading his book, even though it's about 6 years too late. He didn't really give a damn about policy. All he wanted to talk about was or the left and the media was lying. And I think that the one thing Canada doesn't have that America doesn't have is that America has is a revolution. And I think the problem is that in America we have documents to look at, and I'm pretty sure Canada, I don't want to get your history wrong, it was something like in your constitution or some document you basically wrote out Great Britain's rulership over you. And I think that's a little bit different than fighting an actual revolution to be left mm-hmm. alone. And I got that wrong. Please correct it. But I would also
I'm not sure, to be honest. you've done more research on this part than I have.
I am a history buff, so I probably remember that from too far ago. My next question on this topic would have to be, do you see America shifting towards Canadian and Western European-style social democracies where it's kind of like very high redistribution of wealth, very high tax rates, free college, free everything, free being in quotation marks, obviously. Do you see America going on that path?
America, I don't think so. I think that America has definitely moved more towards conservatism, but I think when people say that conservatism is the new counterculture, I think in a lot of ways they're right. I think that Trump kind of brought that out in a lot of people who wouldn't normally consider themselves conservative. I think that they thought, oh, I just want, like, you know, the government to chill out a little bit, and they suddenly became the new conservatives. But I think we need to be very careful with that, because I think if we go too far with seeing conservatism as simply a counterculture and not as, you know, a good set of principles to govern by, I think it's going to be a very short-term win, and that's something that I don't want. I don't think that we're at any risk in the United States of, you know, suddenly becoming Britain or Canada, but I do think some of these ideas culturally need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed very, very carefully, and not in the, you know, new rights way of doing it.
Yeah, and when you look at it, you talked about you're optimistic towards American conservatism, and I have to agree. There's a lot of catastrophes on the right. We think that if we don't go more big government nationalistic, that the right's going to be done. I think when you look at Generation Z, obviously every generation starts leaning left and they move right. But Generation Z actually starts way more towards the center than baby boomers and millennials did, which means that this generation can be sweeping in a lot of conservative politicians if we do the right things, like you say, where we talk about principles, we talk about the good stuff like freedom of speech, freedom to defend yourself. I think that if we don't back off these issues, but instead explain ourselves why it's good and not, it's just been here, we do it like this, this is why we do it. I think if we actually go out there and make the case to a lot of these truth seekers, people who are trying to kind of wade through the chaos, if we make this clear argument instead of being catastrophists, like, oh, you cut like two things out of Obamacare and now everyone's going to die, or that if we don't ban all guns, every politician's going to have their head on a stake. I think that if you're going to be very calm, very cool and collected, take a breath and kind of explain yourself, you'll be fine, which transitions into our last topic, one that I know you're going to be very excited to talk about, the experience of being a millennial in the right-wing media. So my first question, it's going to be obviously probably a sad one for you, is what is the state of the right-wing media in Canada? Do you have one standalone station like a Fox News, or is it just non-existent?
No. Our closest thing to a right-wing station would be Rebel Media, which isn't even on TV. So Canada is in a dire situation when it comes to right-wing media, in my view. There's a couple of papers that are a little more right-wing leaning, but the problem is, in a lot of ways, that the few sources that are right-wing do not reach the people that it needs to reach. It kind of reaches, you know, older people that are already conservative, which is nothing wrong with that. But, you know, this gets back to the culture thing. I think Rebel Media is, you know, an outlet that I support because they absolutely are needed in Canada, because there are certain stories that literally nobody else will even look at. So, you know, God bless them for that. But I'm certainly not appreciating all, some of their current things they're doing. Overall, I support them. And I wish that, I find it kind of happens, though, where a lot of people either sort of straight up move to America, like people that are conservatives in Canada, straight up move to the United States, or they just talk about American stuff like I do, because it's such a difficult environment to do. It's such a difficult thing. I don't think I could, there's no way in the world that I could make a living just being independent right-wing media in Canada. I really don't think I could. Not saying nobody could, but it's definitely an uphill climb here to get any sort of traction.
Yeah, definitely Rebel Media is an interesting one to look at. I've seen a few of Gavin McGinnis's segments where he actually takes like the Harvard girls soccer team, the ones that the boys were suspended for a year for rating them based on their looks, and he actually re-rated them on TV, on YouTube. I'm just going through his channel right now. It's pretty ridiculous. I don't want to say some of the stuff on here because I don't need the higher-ups getting mad at me for repeating what he puts in his titles. So I think that obviously when you have such a left-leaning media, the pendulum is going to swing hard the other way, past conservatism and sometimes into some brash stuff like you see with Gavin McGinnis, Miley Yiannopoulos, and another Canadian, Steven Crowder, who does some pretty outlandish things of himself. So one thing that I think you probably benefit from is the fact that you cover America from a very unique perspective in Canada. I just want to kind of hit on the fact that you do have a pretty large following, and I'm wondering, does Canada have a big market? Is there a niche market among Canadian American conservatives, in a sense, that are looking for a follow, looking for someone to follow like you? Or is it kind of Americans that are actually saying, oh, wow, Canadian conservative? What do they have to say? Where is the mix there?
I get both for sure. I certainly get people that get mad at me and they're like, what do you care? But most of the conservatives in America support me. Everyone's always like, ah, Stephanie, you're our honorary American, move here. You know, I do get Canadian conservatives. Absolutely. I would guess probably hundreds of my followers are Canadian conservatives. It's just definitely a small minority compared to my followers, particularly from the United States. I think I have followers from a lot of places, definitely from Britain, because I talk about, you know, Islamification and things like that all the time. And I know that's a big problem in certain, you know, European countries. And conveniently, you know, they speak English in England, so they can actually understand my tweets and follow me. But yeah, it's definitely interesting to have my perspective. And I also just want to touch on what you said a minute ago, too, about the whole Rebel Media and the direction they're going. I think that ultimately, I really support what they're doing, but I think that more diversity would be good. I wish that diversity of thought, that would be good. I wish that somebody else would open a sort of, I kind of always call it this, I kind of, the visions I make are kind of the new right and the principled conservatives, TM. That's kind of what I call it, because I wish somebody in Canada would start up a principled conservatives, TM sort of thing, because if I'm being honest, I am a little bit of somebody that enjoys a wide range of conservative ideas. I actually am a huge fan of Gavin McGinnis. Certain things he says, I don't agree with at all. But I think it's important that people like that exist, because, as you said in one way, that we need to be careful that we don't move too far to the point where we destroy the left and become this insane right. And I think sometimes Gavin goes pretty far into representing that. And I like to see those ideas out in the open, and I want to see those ideas debated. I mean, Steven Crowder in a different, he does a more of a ridiculous PG-13 way of doing things, but I think they both do it. I just think that the diversity on the right is something that I applaud, and you see a ton of it in America among those people you said. You know, we have everything from, I follow everybody from Gavin McGinnis to Ben Shapiro to, I follow a ton of people. But in Canada, that just does not exist. I feel like in Canada, we have this tiny, tiny proportion of, you know, Canadian journalists like Ezra Levant, Faith Goldie, all these people work at Rebel Media, and then that's it. You know, there's no diversity here. So I would love to see more of it.
Yeah, definitely something that we need to work on the right, I think, is differentiating from diversity of thought when it comes to principles and policy. Tax, I think, is a perfect way to look at it. The principle on the right is typically, when you see tax, it's people want to lower taxes because you deserve more of your wealth. I think that's more important than deciding on whether low equals 10%, low equals 15%. I don't think that's as important as if we agree on the principle.
Exactly.
I think on the left, they just look at the policy. So when they debate universal health care, it's not because they believe in it or not. It's because they think it's too extreme right now for Americans to buy into. That's why in the primary, they thought Bernie was going a little nuts with his Medicare for All. But in 10 years, that could be like, oh, Americans are used to Obamacare now. We can push Medicare for All on them. So I think they're looking at the policy while conservatives are really trying to be principled, which I think is great. I think if you focus on your principles and we can agree, or at least at the worst, understand each other's principles, then we can move forward to create policy. But when you start a policy, you create issues. And now I kind of want to get into the analytical side of what you do. When you're looking at – when you tweet, you like to say you like to be principled and a little bit pragmatic and not blow up these conspiracy theories, whether it be Pizzagate or promoting these Laura Loomer fiasco type events. Does this help or hurt your follower growth? Not in the sense that you tweet something, but in the sense that your whole method is – is your method good for a burst of follower growth or just a consistent linear pattern?
Well, I think that my method is, first of all, full disclosure, the Pizzagate thing is an interesting one because I don't know if you saw anything about this, but I was literally blamed for Pizzagate personally. Yeah, so it's ridiculous because I don't believe in Pizzagate. And at the time, all I said about it was, this is what people are talking about. It's kind of weird. I had like no followers at the time, never thought it would take off like it did. However, I did say recently in a Periscope that I could have used that whole Pizzagate fiasco that the media put me in and used it to do the sort of, like you said, these kind of conspiracy type stories or publicity stunt type stories where I could have said, oh, look at me, they won't let me report this. Come support me. Come give money to my PayPal, you know, like some of these people are doing. And no, I really think that ultimately, short term, I think it hurts me. Honestly, I think there are a lot of things I could do in my social media strategy that would get me a lot more followers, a lot more, you know, Twitter impressions. However, I don't think it's worth it because I think when I do that and I do those sorts of things that are kind of controversial, you get a lot of fair weather friends. I think you get people that see something I say, they say, oh, I like that she said that, and they follow me for that. And the second I say something they disagree with, they're like, I'm out of here. I feel like the vast, vast, vast majority of the followers I have are people who have stuck around for months. You know, people that will have strong disagreements with me on stuff, strong disagreements with me on this, and then strongly agree with me on that. And we have discussions. And I think people come to actually know me as a voice and know the way I look at things and actually take my point of view. So ultimately, I think my strategy is successful. I just think it will take a lot longer than what I believe to be the kind of easy flash in the pan way of getting following.
Yeah, I think that you're being very smart about what you do because there's this confirmation bias that people really expect now with this Laura Loomer stuff and this Jack Posobiec, how you pronounce his last name.
Posobiec.
Yeah, whatever. I don't really care about him too much. He's not really relevant. But the problem is that they want this constant feedback loop where everyone is agreeing with what they say. They want Trump to be this victim. They want the anti-left to be this new victim organization where they just peddle out these conspiracy theories that these plays are going to lead to the assassination of a president and that you need to pay for their legal bills or else something's going to go wrong for them. I don't really know. And I think that when you talk about this change and how people are kind of going after these issues where they're kind of blowing it up, they want to look extreme, they want to look that everything's going to be the end of the world. It's really, really saying something about our politics that we need to go to the extremes to make our point, something which I actually very much disagree with, that we need to go to the extremes to make our point. I think there's a way to stay, like you say, pragmatic, kind of just here's the issue, here's the topic that the issue was brought up on, here's how we can discuss this issue. If you disagree with me, I'm more than willing to respond and we can have this discussion. You don't need to leave just because I say something you don't like.
Exactly. Because,
like you talk about with Ben Shapiro, I mean, I love his show. I watch a lot of his YouTube videos, but I don't agree with everything he says. I think some places he might go too far for me. And I don't think it's a matter of him having a different principle than me. It's him having a different policy than me. And I'm just going back to this. Like, I can have a different policy with him. That's not the difference. We need to agree on the principle that it's not right for me to restrict your speech or me to take away your right to purchase healthcare or your right to carry a gun. That's the important thing. And I think that I want to transition to talking about how the change in reporting has happened. I think over the last 10 years, when you look at the rise of digital media, places like your website that can now exist, do you think this change in reporting has really helped the right where you can now go to an opinion site where you kind of can see what you want to see, and then you can compare it to the mainstream media, see what they're trying to see. So you can kind of see what the right includes in their story, see what the left includes in their story, kind of make your conclusion from there. Do you think that's a beneficial thing for the reader?
I think it's absolutely a beneficial thing. I think that overall, as much as we have issues on the right when it comes to, like, as I call it, the right-wing anti-meritocracy problem, as much as we have our issues in right-wing media, I mean, compared to where we were 10 years ago, I am thrilled. You know, I think that even as somebody who was not on the right 10 years ago, but I see a lot of intellectual diversity. I see a lot of, like you said, the ability to look at a story that's reported on CNN, look at another couple sides of things. And I think that this sort of media literacy, people have kind of, it's actually in a way, it's made certain people more media literate, in my opinion, not less, because people will see some of these stories and then they have to learn to, you know, they'll see something on CNN, then they'll Google it and they'll look at a source and they'll say, Russia Today, for example. And then when they look at that, that some other person will tell them, look, you can't trust Russia Today because it's going to be incredibly pro-Putin. And then they can say, okay, well, maybe I'll look at this source from an American conservative website's point of view, like the National Review. And you can kind of go from those various things and you can learn that certain sources are better on certain things, first of all. I mean, there are certain things that Russia Today reports that the American media does a terrible job of. And there are certain things they report that are Pravda nonsense. And I think that people, when you have this mass amount of media to consume, you actually, I find for me, when I can look at 5 or 6 or 7 perspectives on a single thing, I find it personally really helps me, and it helps me learn a lot. And it also eliminates the elitism in media. You know, I'm a normal mom, you know, I'm a single mom actually. And, you know, I wasn't raised with money. I've never been to I was homeschooled, never been to college, and I'm able to be in media. That was not the case before we had the sort of rise of digital media. So I think that's a very good thing. I think that it's created a bit of populist media, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I think that the very wide, diverse viewpoints we see in the media today is actually a good thing. One point I want to transition to is, I think this might not be too popular of a talking point, but I think it's always important that you have one, at least one topic or website you go to where you disagree with a person on their policies, but you go there and read them anyways. For me, I would have to say that's Vox. I personally think Ezra Klein's pretty far to the left, but I also think that some of the videos he puts out, whether it be the Russia chronologicalizing the Trump-Russia thing or the Syria or North Korea-ish conflicts, I think he does a really good job with those. I think his videos are very interesting. Even when he breaks down some laws, I tend to disagree with his interpretations, but I like to see where he comes from. So I think that if I want to see something from the left, I like to go to Vox. And I also have a Twitter list where I have a bunch of outlets. I want to say right now I have 19. I want to say 9 on the right, 9 on the left, and then I have 538. So I know that when I go through the outlets list on my Twitter, I'm going to see stuff on both sides of the aisle, whether it be National Review, The Hill, Slate, Salon, all that good stuff. I think one thing I want to know from you is, what left-leaning websites, if any, do you read or watch?
Well, I really would like to steal your Twitter list, because that sounds like an absolutely great idea, because some of these places I just end up unfollowing because they drive me crazy, but I'd rather just put them on a list so I can see them, like, you know, in order. I definitely read a little less than I used to. Partly, I think that was just the kind of liberal detox that I naturally went through. But there are some that I still really, one that I particularly look at all the time that I looked at. He did incredible work during the election, particularly with some of the scandals regarding Hillary Clinton and things like that. Is Michael Tracy. When I first heard of him, I think he was just like completely independent, but now he's a Young Turks correspondent. I know the Young Turks of all places, but I find him to be incredibly intelligent. And he has had some extremely good pieces, you know, very like, I don't know, I think I feel like I trust him a lot, even if I disagree a lot on his principles and his, you know, view of policy. That's definitely a big one. I'm trying to think, I feel like there's a couple more. I definitely have a few that are kind of like, I mean, kind of like middle of the road, like Tim Pool, people like that, that are just trying to, like, people that are curious and trying to find truth. I don't read so much some of the ones that I find are just so far afield that it's hard to take them seriously. Like Slate and Salon, I read them once in a while, but it's almost always when I'm just like, oh, good Lord, what have they done now? Sort of thing. But every so often, you know, I quoted I think it was a Salon article in my Laura Loomer article, because they were completely right, you know? So I think you just have to be open to, you just have to be open and curious. And when you feel like there's something missing on the right wing of something, and then you, I think it's a very, very wise thing to consider looking at some left wing sources. I don't think it shouldn't be an unpopular opinion, but that's where we're at right now.
Well, it is tough. You have to imagine that. For me, I know sometimes I just have to close the article when I'm reading something on the left. It can be very caustic for me when I'm just reading something where it's like, listen, I want to understand your point of view, but you're just going crazy. You're not even telling the truth here. You're just trying to get a bunch of clicks. And I think that we have to be fair and say on the right, you have to imagine if someone on the left was taking the same exact approach, then maybe the Daily Wire, maybe National Review, maybe it's a little extreme for them. And maybe they find it hard to read it as well. And I think we have to be honest and say that maybe, yeah, we can read other news sources, but it isn't easy. And I think you said you're reading less. I understand too, because after the election, some of the left stuff was just getting insane. We're just like, I can't go and read one of these articles because, like, I'm not a big Trump guy, but I mean, he's not Nazi, he's not Hitler. So I think that you're being a little unfair. So one thing I want to do, close out, is I want to ask you, since you're using the internet a lot, and I think that's very, very good strategy when it comes to spreading your message. How can millennials get involved if they want to do what you do, or even just contribute on a website like Lone Conservative? Like what can they do to get themselves involved, even if it's just a little thing?
I think the biggest thing that I always say about everything is people need to learn to ask, because when you are willing to put yourself out there and be genuine about who you are and what you're trying to do and that you're willing to learn, you'll be surprised just how many people are willing to give you a chance to learn. And I feel like that's kind of what happened with me. When I first started writing, I've been interested in politics since I was like 12, but around a little before the election last year, I think maybe in like August, I was tweeting about politics a lot, and I was like, you know, I'd really like to write something. I'd like to have a space to write more than 140 characters at a time. So I just started reaching out to these like alternative media type websites. And I ended up reaching out to a site called planetfreewill.com, a small alternative media website. And I was like, hey, can I write some guest pieces for you? See how it goes. And before I knew it, I was writing there like 4 times a week for a while. And it was really good. And then it just kind of grew from there. I think that people, if you're interested in this, if you're a younger millennial and you want to get your voice out there, even if you're like 17, 18 years old, there are outlets out there that will want to hear your point of view. And there are people out there who are willing to work with you on getting you to where you need to be, to the, you know, if that's, you know, writing articles or doing YouTube videos. I just think people need to, if you're interested in the future of your country, it's really important to, even if you're not necessarily involved in politics, it's important to be involved in the discourse, because I don't really believe that anyone can truly be apolitical. I think that even if you say you're apolitical, you're consuming media, you're buying things, you're doing things that, whether you like it or not, affect politics. So having at least a basic understanding is a good thing. And if you're a nerd like me who really wants to get into it, start by talking to people, you know, like tweet me on Twitter. I'll be happy to help you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because as an 18-year-old, I think it's very awesome that Lone Conservative and other websites allow people to contribute, because even 10 years ago, it would not have been possible at my age to do it. And I think that's a very good thing. And as someone who you got entered into it early, I don't think I can't really remember following any politics until maybe the 2014 midterm elections. That was the first time I ever probably turned on Fox News for anything. So I think as someone who's really just come into politics, never really looking at it besides the election before last year, it's very nice that I was able to quickly get up into politics and write at a website. So before I sign off, I want to start a little thing here on the Campus Conservative podcast where we ask a little question, just a little fun outside of politics. It's a little running joke at Lone Conservative about pizza.
Oh no, I'm going to be fired.
Trust me, I'm going to answer this question in a very unpopular fashion too. It's kind of, who does pineapple belong on pizza? It's kind of a running joke. There's few on the one side, few on the other. I personally do not believe it belongs on pizza. Stephanie, what's your take?
Pineapple belongs in the trash. It doesn't just not belong on pizza. It belongs nowhere. It's disgusting.
Well, that is one take I don't think I can disagree. I can agree with. I wish we could agree on something at the end here. I like pineapple. I just don't agree you should cook it. So before we sign off here, just remind everyone where we can find you and what projects, if any, are you working on right now?
Awesome. Well, you can find me, of course, at halseynews.com, H-A-L-S-E-Y, news.com. And you can also find me at writemillennial.com. That's kind of my personal website. I consolidate all of my latest episodes of my YouTube show, Write Millennial. It's kind of an interview show, sort of like this. It's a lot of fun. Have lots of cool guests. I also try to be on as many sorts of podcasts and interviews and stuff like that as possible. You can find that on my website, and I post all of my articles there, including my articles for Lone Conservative, where I've just started writing. I also wanted to let everybody know that we are going to be announcing some pretty big partnerships at Halsey News in the coming weeks, so please just stay on my Twitter and get excited, because we are going to be doing some very big things, and I am extremely excited.
Well, that's awesome. It sounds like you got your plate full, and it sounds like you and you do seem like you're more than capable of handling it. And I am Robert Sasso. You can find me on Twitter at TheReal28. I'm a writer at Lone Conservative, obviously. And check out On the Line TV. We do a great program over there every Thursday night with Cassie Dillon and Alex Sears. Hopefully some more guests coming in the coming months. That's always going to be awesome every week. And I'm signing off. Hopefully we can be here for a long time. And thank you for tuning in.